You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Today, we will be talking about suffering. There are all kinds of suffering, right? Oh, gosh. That was the best. I love our church. I love it. All right. So we're in this series called The Loneliness. And Rachel started us with the topic Alone with God. Then I spoke about being alone with others, ourselves, I mean. And last week, Rachel talked about that kind of rhythm between loneliness and community. Some very serious topics, right? And when I think about that, I want to lighten the mood. I thought I'd close with this playful topic of being alone with suffering. And golly, sometimes I feel like people are like, you guys are like gluttons for punishment, right? Some people might criticize that we're being a little too somber, but the truth is, we're just trying to go deeper, like to open our hearts wider. And I get it, some of these topics may feel like dark caves, deep in there, there's just a bunch of uncertainty and pain. And I get that, but in my experience, those dark caves also hold treasures you can't find anywhere else. Treasures of light. Treasures of deep joy, of unconditional love, maturity, wisdom. So this morning, I'm going to do things a little differently than I've ever done before when I talk about being alone with suffering. I'm not actually going to hand out Bibles. We're not going to do Bibles this morning and put scripture verses up on the screen. I'm going to do this more like a story, like a storyline. I'm going to invite you guys into a narrative with characters and plots. And by the end, my goal is that we would relate better to the words of Charles Dickens in his book, Great Expectations, the cruel Estella says to Pip, "Suffering has been stronger than all other teaching. I have been bent and broken, but I hope into a better shape." So let our story begin. Chapter 1, The Reality of Suffering. So when I was in college, I lived on campus in the dorms. Anyone else live in the dorm life? Yeah, there are a lot of people who lived in the dorm life. Ramen noodles, vending machine meals, community bathrooms, shower caddies, getting almost no sleep, mastering the 10-minute nap, wasting ridiculous hours in the middle of the night because someone came by your room around midnight and said, "Hey, I need to go make a Walmart run." You go there, and because it's raining really hard, you're like, "Hey, we should buy some sleds and just all slide down the muddy hill on campus," and you do that till 4 in the morning, you have a test at 7, you wake up, and then you just live life again. Dorm life, okay? Well, my junior year, I was a chaplain on my floor of guys. It was a Christian college, so chaplain was a real thing, all right? I got a tiny scholarship, not as big as the RAs, but I got a tiny scholarship, and while the RA was there to enforce rules, I held devos on the floor for the layperson, devotionals. And as a floor chaplain, it was my duty to kind of help the incoming freshmen acclimate. Since my floor was mostly returning upperclassmen, we had a lot of athletes on this floor. We only had a couple freshmen, and one of those was a boy named Joshua Strong. And as it turned out, Josh didn't need much help at all acclimating. He was a magnetic personality, full of energy, full of life. He was from Montana. So he seemed like this kid in a candy store trying to take in all of the city life of the big city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I loved him right away, and almost everyone did. He quickly earned the nickname Super Fresh. We all called him Super Fresh. Josh bought a dartboard for his dorm room, and we all would gather there to play darts around empty pizza boxes and 2-liter bottles, Sam's Cola, and Dr. Thunder, if you know what that is. Then he went out and like spent all this, like his whole month's allowance on like this crazy aquarium and filled it with betta fish. And we would all just sit around and watch. Some of the guys would bet on which ones would eat the others, you know, don't call PETA, all right? But just dorm life. But in the down times, I would talk with Josh and I'd get to know him a little bit. He had his walls up at first, but he would slowly bring them down for me, and I learned that under his bright smile, there was a boy trying to find himself. And not like almost everyone is trying to find themselves, in a very deep, intense way. I learned that his dad had died about 6 years previously from a long bout with leukemia. He had an older brother who had Down syndrome. And so when his dad died, he became like the man of the house. And then a couple years later, his older brother then dies. Like most teenagers, it's really hard for him to deal with all of the emotions. In fact, he confessed to me that one of the reasons that he chose the school we went to is that he could get as far away from home as possible. And he and his mom didn't really leave on the best of terms. He had been apparently going through a rather rebellious streak, just trying to pull away and didn't want his mom's interference. Then one night, I was walking around campus, and I got a phone call. And apparently, Josh had been up at the rec center playing basketball. And apparently, in an effort to show off for some girl, likely, he ran up to go and grab the basketball rim, just showing off his ups. And when he grabbed it, his feet flung forward, momentum carrying him, and his hand slipped off the rim, and he went to a kind of half gainer and landed on the back of his head. And when I remember talking with people who were actually there, he said, yeah, you just seem really, like, dizzy and, like out of it. Like, this guy's definitely got a concussion. So they called the ambulance, and the students on the phone told me, like, Josh is being taken in an ambulance to the hospital nearby. Being a chaplain, I was like, well, I got to get over there. So I went over there, jumped in my car so fast, I beat the ambulance there. And when I was there, over the next several hours, just trying to be there, you know how it is in ERs, just there's fast, slow, and you're hearing little bits of information here and there. He got moved from ER to intensive care. I just remember overhearing some of the doctors say something about blood being on the brain. I'm like, that's not good. And I was up there in ICU by Josh's bed when someone handed me a phone. And that's when I was introduced to Josh's mom, Pam. She was up in Montana about to board a plane to fly down the next morning. But in the meantime, she wanted me to stay there and read Psalms over Josh. I still remember Psalm 30 that she asked me to read over him. Lord, my God, I called to you for help, and you healed me. I would sit there, and I would just read these psalms over Josh. And he was awake, but not kind of really not there. His eyes were really big, and it's just like, oh, God, help, help. About 2 or 3 in the morning, I left to go back to campus. I got a couple hours of sleep, and I got another phone call around 8 a.m., and apparently, somewhere in the morning, Josh coded, and they rushed him into surgery. So I was like, oh, great. And so I got there, and we're all waiting around. When he comes out of surgery, he's still breathing, but his zero brain activity. And I remember being like, what? It's like being in the Twilight Zone. Like, I was just joking around with Josh just the other day. And now he's brain dead. In John's Gospel, chapter 9, there's this remarkable story of Jesus healing a blind man. And that's, you know, not that unique because he really does heal a lot of blind people. But considering the details, it is pretty remarkable. For instance, in this one occasion, he spits into some mud and rubs it together and puts it in the blind man's eyes, which seems kind of gross to us, but in the ancient world, they viewed saliva to have healing properties, so it kind of made sense to them. And then Jesus asked the blind man to go and wash himself in a famous pool. And I found that to be really interesting. Jesus gave him work to do. Like, he had to participate in his healing. Like, we cooperate with the divine. We often have a role to play in our own healing. And I could just totally end the sermon right there. But I like to talk, so I'm going to continue and drag this out. My favorite part of the story is that Jesus healing the blind man is how it starts off. They're walking along, and the disciples turn to Jesus, and they ask him a truly human question. Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents? In other words, who's to blame, Jesus? And Jesus' answer is basically none of the above. No blame. Not even really a satisfactory explanation. He says that this happened before, you know, so that God's glory can be revealed, but that may be for this one instance, but that doesn't explain this existential problem of people being born blind, Of course, in this story, he does do something about it, which is beautiful. But here's the uncomfortable truth. Jesus didn't heal all the blind people. And even after he resurrected and ascended, he left behind a world where people continue to be born blind. So I remember being in the ICU with Josh by myself, and that feeling was just so isolating. I felt so powerless, I felt defeated, afraid. And then literally, like, I remember this moment viscerally. The door opens, and Pam comes into the room, his mom, in just a flurry of faith. She had organized prayer network over the whole continent of North America. Like, she was quoting scripture, and we had work to do. You're Joel, nice to meet you. Let's do some praying, right? And it was, like, amazing. Her energy was infectious. I began to have hope again. I started to put my trust in God in a way that I don't know if I ever had up until that point. We prayed, we consulted with doctors, and I started to believe Josh is going to be healed. Like, this is the kind of God I serve. Josh is going to be healed. And over the next day, several members of the family and friends came in and out. Pam showed her continued strength. She spoke faith, infusing others with courage, encouragement. But eventually, the doctors explained that nothing was changing and it was only the breathing machines that were keeping him going. So Pam was forced to make the difficult decision to take Josh off of life support and see what happens. And I don't know how, but I was the only non-family member in this room when they took Josh off life support. We were crowded around his bed. There was probably like 15 to 20 of us. And we all just collectively watched the monitor as Josh's heart slowed and stopped. And in one hand, I'm like, I thought that might happen, but on another hand, I was like, I couldn't wrap my arms around reality in that moment. And here was Pam, so full of faith. She believed. And afterward, I was standing out in the hallway, just kind of by myself. You guys know hospital hallways, they just feel so sterile. And there's like flickering fluorescent lights, and I felt like I didn't belong with the family here. I hardly knew any of them, and they were starting the early stages of grief, and I just didn't feel like I belonged there. And Pam must have saw me because she came over to me, her face just etched with grief. I mean, here's a woman who buried her husband 6 years prior after his fight with cancer. Buried her oldest son, who had a genetic disorder, taking care of him his whole life, and now just buried her son in this freak accident. She didn't even get to say goodbye. And she stared up at me. You know, I could see her eyes. She was a small woman, and I was looking through her tears and her big round glasses. And I was 20. Like, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to think. And she looked up at me, and I will never forget as long as I live what she said to me. She told me, Joel, we pray that God would spare my son. We ask that God would heal Josh. And he said, no. And then she just went silent. You know, many Bible students point to the book of Job as a treatise on the problem of pain and suffering. And, you know, perhaps you guys remember the story. The setup is there's this righteous man. His name is Job. He's a blessed man. And so in the story, Satan has this weird, like, bet with God. He challenges God and says Job would not be so upright, he would not be so righteous if he wasn't so privileged. And so God takes his bet in this story. And one by one, calamities fall on Job as God lifts his hand of blessing. A servant rushes up to Job. A group of bandits attacked, and they took all your oxen, they took all your donkeys, and every one of the servants that were there all died except for me, who escaped to give you this news. Another servant came. Fire fell from heaven on all your sheep and other servants. They're all dead. The Chaldeans raided a herd of your camels, took all of those, killed all the servants and set for me. And the lastly, and bearer of bad news, the most difficult was a mighty wind blew down the house where all your sons and daughters were feasting, and now they're all dead. In chapter 1, verse 21, records Job's famous words to all of this bad news. He says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Whoa! God gives and takes? It's almost an insane reply, if you just think about it. That's an insane reply. That's kind of how I felt when I heard Pam talk to me that day. We prayed that God would heal Josh, and he said no. What? Chapter 2, the response to suffering. So I like how Nelson Mandela says it. Our human compassion binds us one to the other, not in pity or patronizingly, but as human beings who have learned how to turn our common suffering into hope for the future. Not a quote from someone living in some ivory tower, if you know his story. So me and a couple guys from the floor decided to drive up to be a part of the funeral. And these were some of the crazier guys on the floor. They were athletes on the track team. And this was Thanksgiving break. It had just become Thanksgiving break, right before this accident. Thanksgiving break happened right after this accident. So I drove up to Kansas, where one of the guys lived, and we borrowed his mom's minivan, and we took the trek up to Billings, Montana. Within an hour, we got our first of 3 speeding tickets. These were just crazy guys, okay? And I honestly, I'm a rule follower, guys. I've just always kind of been that way. And these guys, I was a little uncomfortable with their untethered frivolity. And I was also, their chaplain, so I had that weird, am I supposed to be a good example for them? I don't really know. And then one of the guys challenged when he saw it was cold out, it was snowing outside, it was just wicked cold, and he said, "Let's do freeze out." And I'm like, "What's freeze out?" So I joined him mindlessly as all of them, including the driver, stripped down to our underwear. We're driving on the highway here, guys. I'm in the back seat. I'm going, taking off my clothes, what's happening? They put all the windows down. It's 10 degrees outside. The first one to put their clothes on loses. Guys, I lost big time. I put them on thinking, now they're going to put their clothes on. Nope. The guy who lasted the longest was turning blue by the end of it. It was just crazy. We finally get to Billings, Montana, and we 4 guys arrive, and we are being bombarded by family and friends. And it was understandable. No one had seen Josh in 4 months. And suddenly he dies days before his scheduled trip back for Thanksgiving break. And instead of Josh, they get a coffin. And they ask questions about Josh since school started. Was he making friends? Was he happy? Did his faith start to recover? They called us angels of light. I'm serious. Most of them we had never met before ever. But they said we were like angels, heralding messages from God, filling in the gaps, and offering comfort to a grieving community. So they asked us, angels of light, to be pallbearers. The funeral had over 500 people in attendance. Billings may be one of Montana's larger cities, but that ain't saying much, It felt like the whole city turned out to be at Josh's funeral. And beforehand, before they let everyone into the sanctuary, there was this side room that the friends and family were in. There was about 40 or 50 of us. We're in the side room, and they told us, I'm assuming the funeral directors or the pastors, I don't remember, said that we'll allow you guys to have one last visitation before we open the doors and let in the masses. And somehow I must have been next to the door because I was one of the earlier ones in the line. And I went up, you know, kind of filed in front of the coffin, and I looked down. I said goodbye to Josh. But I moved by quickly. I didn't want to take up too much time while I wanted to give time for the family. And so I went and sat down on a pew just there by myself. Side note. When I was in high school, I remember the first time I was assigned to write a Shakespearean sonnet. Did anyone have that assignment in English class, a Shakespearean sonnet? I had to write one of those, and I actually enjoyed the process very much. And I was even proud of the poem I wrote, so much so I recall this vivid memory. And there was this girl who I respected. She was very artsy, and we would just have to be talking after school one day, and we weren't really close, but I remember I was holding my poem, and I was like, oh, I would love to read you my poem. Would you want to hear it? And she's like, yeah, that's great. So I read my poem to her, and I remember her looking very seriously at me and said, whoa, Joel, that was heavy. And I just stared back at her like, what? Was it? I mean, it was inspired by the fact that as a freshman in high school, I felt like all my best friends abandoned me to chase the typical trappings of adolescence. You know, booze and girls, etc. Meanwhile, I was digging more and more into my youth group. I even ended the poem with this nice little line about how God hadn't left me. See, it's a happy poem. But this girl saw that what the poem was, even if I didn't. It was my pain, my hurt from feeling abandoned, even rejected. I wasn't cool enough for my friends. And it was a silly, brooding sonnet, nothing profound. But somehow, art has a way of bringing those feelings to the surface, even against our will. And I was honestly really uncomfortable with the response. I remember telling it, it's not that bad. I'm fine. But I don't think I was. I have a buddy who often tells me, pain is pain. Whether you stub your toe or you get stabbed with a knife, both can appropriately respond by saying, ouch. Pain is pain. I want to read a passage for you from the book of Romans. And I really want you to listen to the high call that Paul gives these churches. He says, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. It's a high call, right? High call. And I tend to zero in on those last words, mourn with those who mourn. In other words, Paul is saying, mourning, grief, belongs. It's supposed to be there. Just like joy is supposed to be there, so is grief. It's the appropriate response to suffering. And how much more beautiful that Paul reminds us of the importance of doing so within community. So as I was sitting there on the pew, watching people file by Josh's coffin, I saw over to the side my buddies I drove up with. The three of them were kind of moving down the line. They were towards the end. And when they got there, unlike me, they did not move quickly past it. And they stopped and they huddled around Josh's coffin. And I was sitting there going, feeling a little bit left out. And regretting that I didn't spend more time. I got up and I went over and kind of stood behind them, and they spaced out, made room for me. We all put our arms around each other. And I heard some of them sniffling. One of them whispered, goodbye, Josh. Heard another one say, we'll miss you super fresh. And I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I need other people's emotions to help me access my own. I don't know why I'm like that, but That happened for me. And I felt the flutter in my stomach, and it began to rise and just started leaking out. And there we were, four angels of light, softly shaking together as one. Chapter 3, the recovery from suffering. So there is a quote that Pam has cited to me many times over the years. I've noticed it show up. She says, "I want to live not just somehow, but triumphantly." On a personal note, over the past couple years, I've noticed that my body is starting to break down. I'm 40, right? And nothing dramatic. I don't heal that fast anymore. A couple years ago, I somehow injured my groin. Wait for it. On the rowing machine at the Y. I must have been doing it wrong. I don't know. But like, it was awful. And if I just moved in the wrong way, the stabbing pain would just go down my leg. One time, Selah was climbing a tree in our front yard, and she jumped out, and I caught her, which I'd done many, many other times. But it just hit me in the wrong way, and it's just like a shooting pain. My knees buckled, and we both just fell to the ground. And I'm just like, it'll heal. My body heals. Nope. 6 months later, it's the same. Nothing had changed, and I realized I needed to do something about it. I needed to be part of my own healing. And so I went to the chiropractor, and they started, like, helping me, like, learn how to take care of my body. And what I liked about my chiropractor is he saw my pain. Like, he saw it and said, yeah, that's real. Kind of, you know, he saw it. Like the movie Avatar, the blue aliens. I see you, all right? That's how I felt. And even though my injury understandably elicited jokes about getting old and having a questionable groin, my chiropractor just saw me in pain, and he wanted to help. And several months ago, I joined an MMA gym, you know, because I'm on this path of healing my body. But seriously, I'm absolutely loving it. I'm mostly doing Muay Thai, learning boxing, kicking and hitting bags, working out a lot of pent-up aggression, which I apparently have. And one of the first things I had to learn in my class was the warm-up stuff, and it was jump roping. Guys, how long has it been since you jumped rope? It had been a long time for me. And when I started doing it, like, we just warm up with 3 minutes of straight jumping rope. I lasted like 60 seconds before I thought I would die. Like, I'm just like looking around, and you know, like, peer pressure doesn't impact me anymore. I don't care about that. You know, I'm just like, I'm just about to die. That's okay. Now, over time, I started getting better cardio, and I could do the full 3 minutes. But what I started noticing is that around minute two, I started getting this crazy headache that would just take over. It's apparently a real thing that happens for some people. And I started getting this massive headache. Sometimes I would just push through it to the 3 minutes. Other times I couldn't because it would just ruin everything. And I was mentioning it to another guy in class once, and he sort of laughed at me and rolled his eyes. And he attributed it to some fake disease that had the word vagina in it. Oh, so that's the opposite of I see your pain, right? And I actually just laughed too. I don't feel shame about that stuff anymore. You know, I'm too old for shaming tactics like that to work on me. And he's a nice guy, actually. I don't think less of him for not acknowledging my pain. Why didn't you treat me like my chiropractor or like the blue aliens, right, from Avatar? Why didn't you treat me like, I don't know. My guess is that it has something to do with the gladiator culture he came from. That many of these younger guys come out of, machismo, don't show weakness. And I get that many people grow up in scenarios like that, rough situations where dismissing pain and dismissing weakness, it's kind of helpful at a certain time for your survival. But at some point, it stops being helpful. At some point, it starts actually being counterproductive. As we grow, we have to acknowledge there is the reality of suffering, and there is the response, but it is our response that determines whether or not recovery happens. Some people only make it to chapter 2. To this day, Pam still sends a newsletter to our family around Christmas. Sends it to all our friends and family. It's super long, super detailed about all the updates about her, her remaining son, Andrew, his family. He's got kids now. She's got grandkids. She's a nurse, helps lead a grief recovery group at her church. And on the newsletter, she always writes in pen a little note to me. Encouragement. How grateful she is that God used me in Josh's life. She's super sweet. And I reach out to Pam this week via email. And whenever I tell Josh a story, I like to connect with her and just let her know the impact that Josh and she had on my life. But this time, I specifically want to ask her about her recovery. Like, how did God use people on your path to healing? And in typical Pam fashion, she responded by writing me a short novel. But boy, it was full of gold. So can I share a couple of my favorite tidbits from it with you guys? She said before Josh had even died, she was already in that process of grief due to her husband and her oldest son dying. And she told me she was in 3 different groups with other women, and they would encourage one another all the time. And she admitted that several of the women had not experienced any loss ever, certainly not burying 3 people from their family back to back. Yet, for her, it was vital to have a group of trusted friends where they could share their hurts and their questions. And one of the craziest things she told me was that the morning after Joshua died, like the morning after he died, she got up to do her quiet time. But she was unable to engage prayer or reading her Bible. She was just too broken. But she felt God tell her to write down things that are true. So in her email to me, she wrote down, these are the 3 things I wrote down. God is good. God can be trusted with everything. And Joshua is happy in heaven. Guys, bear in mind, this is not a woman dismissing or ignoring her pain. She's not living in la-la land and delusion. To this day, I've never met a person more accepting of the grieving process than Pam Strong. And allow me to quote some of her email here. She shared how a pastor told her about to look for tender mercies, you know, in the midst of the suffering. And I don't know about you, I can get skeptical of stuff like that. Oh, look for the tender mercies. Look for the silver lining kind of BS. I'm just like, come on, your son just died. Chill out. But she took it seriously. Like, look for the tender mercies. And in retrospect, she began to see God's tender mercies all around her. She said, it didn't remove my grief, but it did make it lighter. And here's the quote. She says, grief is a deep, long journey. I will always miss my precious loved ones, and I talk with God about the holes and questions as I live and love my life now. But, and here she quotes one of her favorite quotes, I want to live not just somehow, but triumphantly. How I want purpose and influence in my life to be a conduit that God works through in the midst of intense pain and digging for him in the midst. He is giving me that purpose. She reminds me of Jacob from the Bible. Maybe you remember his story. He's the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. He's one of the patriarchs, the man who famously wrestled with God, refused to let go until he was blessed, and from that day forward walked with a limp, bearing a new name, Israel, the one who struggles with God. That's Pam Strong. And I say this with no hesitation or any hint of irony. She is and will probably always be one of my heroes. So it's a 3-chapter story. the reality of suffering, the response to suffering, the recovery from suffering. But there is an epilogue. You know, one time during the most horrible persecution of the Jews by the Nazis in Poland, there's a story of an old Jewish, cemetery keeper. And he came into the cemetery one morning and found that during the night, a woman had crawled into one of the open graves, gave birth to a baby, and then died. And he found that child, and he said to himself and to others, "This must be the Messiah, for only the Messiah would choose to be born in a grave." It wasn't the Messiah. The child died later that day. You know, we moderns aren't as familiar with death, largely because of our medical advancements. But in the not-so-distant past, our ancestors had a much more visceral relationship with mortality. And the truth of which that cemetery keeper spoke is absolutely accurate. Only the Messiah would choose to be born in a grave. Now, I read several theological articles in preparation for this message, which may surprise you because I told mostly just stories. But just side note, Rachel and I take this stuff, like preaching sermons, very seriously. We want them to be very thoughtful and to connect. But there was a quote from a nameless, non-famous theologian that struck me when I read it. It says, "Suffering may be the consequence of God's decision to create the universe of a particular kind, but he actively shares in the experience." I'll read that again. "Suffering may be the consequence of God's decision to create the universe of a particular kind, but he actively shares in the experience." If you'll stand with me. So this is the conclusion of our series of loneliness. And no matter how isolating our feelings may be, we are truly never alone. Emmanuel, God with us. And joy of joys, he understands. Not on like some cognitive level, like a scientist observing for some sick experiment. He gets it on a human level. The story of the incarnation, the story of the cross, the story of the gospel, in my opinion, is the most compelling story I've ever heard in terms of a trustworthy God. Our world's history has many stories about the divine, but honestly, most of them make me feel separated from God, disconnected, like I'm an irrelevant cog in the machine of our cold universe. But Jesus changes that for me. Me and God have some common ground. We have overlap, a through line. And what is that common thread that I share with the creator of galaxies, you ask? Suffering. Suffering. We share suffering, huddled together, softly shaking as one. So I contend that hope is not some pie-in-the-sky ideal. It's real. And I pray that you find God's tender mercies in your story too. So now to him who's able to keep you from falling, to present you before his glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, be glory, power, majesty, and authority through Jesus Christ our Lord, now and forevermore, throughout all the ages. And we all say, give someone a hug on your way out.